pleased to introduce Dr. Kalashri, who's come all the way from India, from the University of Madras, and where she is the Associate Dean in Research and Associate Professor at the School of Social Sciences, and she's also involved in an India-UK education
network
yeah. with the Queen's University in Belfast. And she'll be talking to us today about tracking the trajectory of religious material culture of Tamil Nadu. And with that, I'll leave it over to you.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Just a brief introduction before I actually begin on my talk. The focus of my lecture today is going to be twofold. The article first will discuss how the objects are construed in a ritual context or in a religious context, and the continuities that are seen in the process of engagement between the people and the objects. Secondly, I want to explore some of the innovations and the changing dynamics in the engagement between the people and the objects. In other words, how do ritual objects undergo changes and commoditization and are recontextualized in a non-ritual setting or in a non-religious setting, and how sometimes the mundane commodities accrue value in a ritual context. And hence I've chosen the word trajectory in the title, and I've called it the trajectory of religious materials, because I want to convey the notion that objects and images are moving and they have a path and they have forms, functions, meanings and values that are on the one hand reproduced as in the past and on the other hand are dynamically improvised in today's world that is propelled by the forces of globalization, modernization and migration, and thereby they have a dynamic life and a biography of their own. So I want to elaborate on these aspects by using relevant examples. I will be drawing on a number of examples from a community called the Nagarathars, which is basically a Tamil community. They hail from the Vaishya caste system, and they live predominantly in Tamil Nadu, although they have migrated to other countries, which include Singapore, Malaysia, North America, and the UK. The references that I've used in my lecture are by no means exhaustive, but merely suggestive. And I've also tried to negate as many Tamil words as possible. In most instances, I've tried to give the closest English translations. However, it has been unavoidable in certain cases, in which case I'd be more than happy to clarify if I've used a Tamil word. Okay, to begin with, I try to make a connection with the objects and the framework of ethnicity and ethnic identity. Ritual objects play a key role in the expression of a group's identity, ethnicity, or cultural uniqueness, or the specificity, and thereby in creating boundaries between groups and in demarcating one group from another. Ethnicity is part of the social logic of practices of defining oneself and one's group by contrast and opposition to other individuals and other groups. However, ethnic groups and ethnicity itself are notoriously difficult to define, and often the words ethnicity and ethnic identity are used interchangeably. In a 2001 work, it contends that the relationship between material culture, rituals, and everyday life are likely to be specific to a particular culture. 2009 work reinforces that ethnicity can be incorporated progressively through an exploration of the performative practices, which includes rituals and the presentation of culturally specific objects. In the study of musical instruments in 2001, the adjectives used to describe objects include indigenous, ethnic, rare, vintage, and so on, which implies a process of exoticization by searching for an affiliation between objects and a specific ethnic group or a certain time. Rogan in 2005 talks about how items of popular culture become not only souvenirs or collectibles, but also representations and carriers of culture. Another work of Franklin and Fessler in 1999 established that all people and their objects are imbued with ethnic overtones, whether it be in the meals they consume, the clothing that they wear, or the spaces that they inhabit. In 2007, Fabian describes how objects help identify tribes and their cultural units, which eventually served to establish boundaries. So when I use the adjective Nagarathar to their lamps or to their jewelry or to the sacred designs, it is used to classify the things and the people. The process of otherness establishes the boundary that separates and differentiates the Nagarathar objects from those of the other communities, and at the same time includes them within the larger Hindu society. All Hindu rites of passage use ritual things during the performance. Though there are similarities among the usage of the ritual things in a broad sense, there are obvious differences denoting varied ethnic ritual performances. For example, all Hindu rites of passage comprise of jewels, lamps, and kolams, which is what you see on the photograph, a ritual floor design. However, it is the typology of these ritual things that determine the ethnicity of the objects and the ritual performance. Among the Nagarathars, they deploy a Nagarathar kolam, or a floor design, as you see on the image on the left, and they deploy Nagarathar jewelry, as you see on the right image, during the rituals of their community. And these serve as markers of their Nagarathar ethnicity and ethnic identity. Nagarathars adopt specific designs for specific rituals. For example, during certain rituals, which are pre-puberty rituals, certain types of ritual designs are common, and the others are more specific to the Nagarathar community. However, I will shortly be dealing with how some of the Nagarathar ritual objects are markers of Nagarathar identity and create boundaries, but at the same time, some of the Nagarathar objects have seen blurring boundaries and have been recontextualized in non-Nagarathar spaces. Coming to another concept which is very common among the Nagarathar community, the borrowing of ritual materials or material things that can be used in religious ceremonies is commonly seen among the Nagarathars. The ritual materials can be borrowed from a community center which houses several ritual objects, including their jewelry, while there are no rental charges for borrowing these materials from the community center. All borrowers pay a certain token sum of money to the center, which goes towards maintaining the center and the properties in it. Ritual things are also borrowed from another resource, which is called as a joint family property, usually maintained by the eldest son of a family or of a lineage. This joint family property comprises things which have been passed down from one generation to another and often lent to immediate and distant patrilineal and matrilineal kin members, and sometimes to friends as well. In some instances, during the performance of ceremonies which have gone out of practice for several decades, as have been established in the works of 2009 of Shrin and Nishimura in 1998, and are witnessing a sporadic revival. These common resources prove to be particularly useful in obtaining the necessary ritual objects. During material exchanges and transactions, the objects also become emotional agents of the giver and the receiver. For example, the lending and borrowing of ritual materials are done with feelings of willingness. Lending things for ritual performances is believed to bring good fortune and blessings for the family of the lender. Similarly, borrowing did not involve any sense or feelings of inadequacy or inferiority. On the other hand, Nagarathars believed that using age-old things would bring good luck. Similar notions and interrelated concepts that have been detailed in the works of Pierce in 2003 and Mines in 1997. In 2003, Pierce analyzes the way in which objects accumulate meanings as time passes and how meaning and value develop as an interactive process between the object and the person. Mines in 1997 talks about the intertwined continuity between the past and the present of people and objects, and how the qualities of the person can be transferred to an object. Therefore, the more number of times the objects have been used in past ritual performances, the more value and sanctity they exude, and the greater their ability to bring good fortune for the contemporary user. The works of Arjun Appadurai in 1986 and Kopitoff in 1986, and Hoskins in 1998, established that the biography of people and things are intertwined. The person is the object, and the object is the person. A corollary of this position is Gell's concept in 1998 of agency and index. The Nagarathar object, the sacred chain, for example, becomes an index of the agency of the person who made the object, the person who procured it, of the person who first wore it, of the subsequent wearers, and of the keeper of the object. The sacred chain, which has been worn several times, is therefore believed to have greater value and power to bring good fortune to the current user. It is common practice among the Nagarathar diaspora and the Nagarathars who live in other parts of India to return to their native villages for the performances of important ceremonies and rituals. A couple in Canada explained to me, "We wanted to conduct the marriage of our daughter in our ancestral house in our native village, because a house that has been passed down from generations is considered auspicious. Therefore, we believe that our daughter's married life will be happy if we conduct her ceremony in that house." Yet another couple elaborates, "Our ancestral house has been a space where several auspicious occasions were celebrated. It is a house that carries good omen. It's only natural that I would want to conduct my son's wedding in this house to ensure that his married life is a happy one." Another Nagarathar woman says, "Several of my relatives have gotten married in the family's ancestral house. They are all living happily. Therefore, I believe that my ancestral house is a house that brings good luck." All of the above interviews convey two strong beliefs among the Nagarathars. One, that the place in which a rite of passage is performed is an important choice and the spatial efficacy has the ability to mediate positive or negative emotions in the lives of the ritual participants. Secondly, the older the place of performance and the more celebrations it has accommodated, the greater is its power to bring good fortune. The construction of a sacred pole during select life cycle ceremonies is guided by strict protocols regarding the place in which it is to be constructed, the substances used in the creation, and the people who should be involved in the production and construction process. The pole is to be erected in the inner courtyard of a Nagarathar house. The family members, usually in numbers of 5, 7, or 9, construct the pole, tie mango leaves and flowers to the top of the pole, and smear it with turmeric paste. Turmeric is an element which is considered auspicious and is a symbol of ritual auspiciousness among the community members. Servants are not allowed to help with the construction process, as may be the case in several other procedures, because they usually belong to a caste that is lower to that of the Nagarathars, and therefore their participation is considered to pollute the object and the space. This normative protocol that taboos the involvement of lower caste people in the ritual construction and into the ritual space reinforces, legitimizes, and perpetuates the existing social hierarchy. Similarly, the making of a sacred chain for a particular ritual is to begin on an auspicious day at an auspicious time, which is determined by the Tamil ritual calendar. A Nagarathar says, one must follow all these stipulations of the production and construction carefully. Following traditions halfway through has no values in ceremonies. Also, breaking norms might bring something untoward for the person or the family for whom the ceremony is to be conducted. This belief once again bears directly on the concept of object efficacy. The people of this community believe that if the ritual object is not constructed in accordance with the traditional prescriptions, it will not accrue value, power, and therefore will not have the ability to bestow the participant with a good fortune, or worse, it might have a negative effect and bring bad fortune to the participant. Thus, the ritual object becomes a powerful emotional agent and a mediator of fear among the members of this community. Yet another stipulation concerning the ritual construction of the sacred pole is that once the pole has been constructed, the principal participants of the ceremonies, the patrilineal and the matrilineal kin, do not participate or attend any events that are considered inauspicious or polluting, such as death rituals, until the completion of the original ceremony. They are also prohibited from staying overnight in any other house or taking trips involving overnight stay. Due to such imposed restrictions on the performers and their kin, today this ritual object is not constructed a few days before the ceremony, as was done in the earlier times, but on the morning of the ceremony. As a result, the ritual abbreviation, a concept used by Stahl in 1996 and Ghani in 2004, was induced by this ritual object, and this has caused a change in the Nagartha ritual syntax and in their tradition. The sacred bracelet is another object which is used during some of the ceremonies of the Nagarathars. The sacred bracelet is an object which is tied to the hand of the ritual participant. An elderly Nagrathar lady says, "This bracelet literally means protection and is believed to safeguard the child from evil forces. But that doesn't mean that he can go anywhere after the bracelet is tied. In fact, once the bracelet is tied, it must be respected and the child is not allowed to leave the house. After the completion of the ceremony, the bracelet is untied by the uncle and then he's free to move around." These words again show two things. First, that imagination plays a key role in constructing a safe and protected space. And secondly, the dichotomy of the house space and the outside space, as already established previously during the ritual of sacred pole. Once again is reiterated the belief that ritual objects are to be respected and feared so that they accrue auspiciousness to the fullest. Moving to the second focus of my lecture, where we talk about the changes, the transformations, and the innovations and the creative improvisations that can be seen during the commoditization of objects. Material culture started to reflect the rapid change in societies around the globe. Some of the factors that induced the change have been identified in 2005 in a work which included industrialization, modernization, expansion of trade and administration. A 2006 work discusses how material forms of religious expression adapt to different existential, intellectual, and social conditions. Shanks and Tiley in 1987 argue how changes in things reflected movement of people and the diffusion of ideas. Svasek in 2007 explores how aestheticization is often influenced by socioeconomic factors. In 2009, Chenoweth considers the variability and the changing nature of material aspects of a group and establishes that even the changing material culture aids the comprehension of the cultural and social identities which are ephemeral in nature. Changes in the value, in the uses, and in the meanings of the objects and its circulation have been theorized by many scholars. Apadure in 1986, Kopitoff in 1986, and Hoskins in 1998 refer to this in their works as the social lives and cultural biographies of objects. In 1997, Davis, while using the same biographical approach, refers to the changing value of objects as shifts in modes of life. While Sharman in 2004 and Svasek in 2007 used the term transition to refer to this concept. Svasek in 2007 refers to the movement of the objects across time and space as transit. These conceptualizations provide a relevant framework for the analysis of the changes in the ritual things in Tamil Nadu. Therefore, in a commodity market where there is an insatiable appetite for new things, where every aspect of life and art is convertible into an object of fascination or desire, creativity is seen as the key to commercial success. This was also commented by the works of Hallam and Ingold in 2007. Being in a world which is never the same from one moment to the next not only opens up a space for improvisation but also demands it if people are to respond to these conditions. The Nagrathar ritual objects have themselves undergone changes due to factors such as increased affluence and migration. The rising prosperity of the community members in the 20th century is visible in the transformation of many of the ritual objects. These objects have become symbols and a reflection of the socio-economic status of the families. The beaded chain, which is used during certain rituals, are made according to the economic capabilities of a family. The affluent families make this chain ornamental with a lot of gold and even diamond studded, while those who cannot afford as much use the gold very sparingly or just a turmeric smeared thread. The silver plate, which is used during certain rituals and ceremonies, is also fast replacing the wooden plate, and so is also the case with the transformation of the lamps. Silver lamps are replacing the clay lamps, and today another convenient choice in lamps is the ones fitted with electrical bulbs. These lamps are sold in ritual accessory stores, along with the adapters to suit different countries around the world, making it a very interesting choice for a souvenir while going abroad. In fact, when I go to many of these ritual accessory stores to buy any of these lamps, I'm always asked, which country are you taking it to? And they all come with these adapters to suit the different countries. Today, several antique stores sell ancient ritual objects or replicas of the antique design. These are bought by tourists for their exotic value and by local consumers for their antique value. For example, here is a picture of a spoon that was used in temple rituals. This spoon, which was brought from an antique dealer in Pondicherry, has now become a curio item adorning the center table of a living room in Chennai. The owner says, "During a party at my house, my wife puts some flowers in it or fills it with water and places a floating candle on it, or sometimes we leave it as it is. This polished, unique item with all its intricate carvings is bound to anyway attract compliments about my tasteful choice." Yet another piece is this ancient type of kumkum holder. Just to explain, the kumkum is the powder which is used by a Hindu woman to adorn the forehead as a dot. This piece is today commonly found in many antique stores and other handicraft boutiques. A lady in Chennai says, "This is one of my favorite objects in my living room. Every time I pass by it, I cannot resist giving it a glance. What an elaborate and beautiful container for kumkum. Look at the hideous manner in which women store kumkum today in plastic boxes. The women of ancient times sure lived in style." And yet another woman in South Chennai says, "As this container has many compartments, I use it to store after-meal mouth fresheners, nuts and dry fruits." Here is a photograph of a sculpture that was retrieved from a temple chariot. This sculpture, which was bought from an antique dealer, can be found mounted in the curio shelf of a living room in Chennai. This photograph shows an array of implements which are used during religious ceremonies and temple rituals, such as lamps, camphor flame holders, holy water jugs, bells, and so on. These objects are displayed at Dakshina Chitra, which is a heritage center and ethnographic museum in the suburb of Chennai. Well, I could go on to give n number of examples as to how these objects are in circulation and are being recontextualized, but I want to quickly come to specifically focusing on three objects which I have chosen where I quickly want to trace the trajectory or the path of how it has been moving. The kolam is a ritual design which is an essential element in most Hindu rituals, including the Navratri rituals. Every auspicious ceremony would require the place in which it is being conducted to be ceremoniously decorated. These designs are put up not just for aesthetic appeal, but more importantly because of the community's beliefs in their ability to invite prosperity, exude sanctity, and ward off evil forces. Women, therefore, by creating these designs, transform the otherwise ordinary space, such as the thresholds and private halls, into a ritual and sacred space. These designs also demonstrate the ethnicity of the particular community through their unique type and style. There are literally hundreds of types of kolam designs, each with their unique features and styles. There are some with dots and lines, some with just lines alone, some which are drawn freehand, with nature often serving as inspirations for their designs. Several of them consist of designs of animals, birds, trees, flowers, fruits, and vegetables. Different types of traditional materials are used to draw these designs, ranging from rice powder to rice paste and multicolored powders. As kolam is a woman's art and a time-consuming one, while most women execute this art, they use it as the time to socialize the next generation into this art form and turn it into an informal workshop and demonstration of how it is to be done. Studies have shown how women in general are responsible for the transmission of family, ethnic, and religious identity to their children in the works of Alba in 1990 and Hyman in 1995. The quality of the objects may objectify the person who have made them and used them. A thing well crafted or created embodies the skill, energy, knowledge, and the spiritual qualities of the maker, as said in Mackenzie's 1998 work. The concept of interwoven gender identities and the objects have also been discussed by Mackenzie and Hoskins in 1998. Therefore, an excellently created kolam ritual design is an embodiment of a traditional Navratri womanhood. In the recent times, a new category of ritual designs are emerging to meet the requirements of the diaspora consumer. There are several ritual accessory stores in India that have begun to cater to the needs and demands of the diaspora. Ritual things are made out of otherwise unconventional and non-traditional materials. The wooden and carpeted floors in houses abroad hinder the drawing of kolam with traditional materials such as rice powder or wet rice batter, which needs to dry overnight. Therefore, the designs made in wooden boards, stickers, woven rugs, as you can see on the image on the right, have become a convenient replacement for the traditional one. And as ethnic boutiques and ritual stores display these items side by side the traditional versions, many of these modernized versions have now found their way into several domestic altars and ritual celebrations in Tamil Nadu. The changes in the objects in ritual performances have thus led to the mass production and commoditization of sacred materials and ritual objects. Also, several industries like the jewelry, the ritual accessories, the food, silversmiths and goldsmiths are now carving a niche for themselves by recognizing the need and demand for ethnicizing their products. The production houses and service industries educate themselves on the requirements of various ethnic groups. This is the image of the column which has been created on the wooden board as opposed to the earlier one on the wood, on a rug. The concept of art by intention and art by appropriation, which was coined by Errington in 1998, while discussing art and artifacts, was based on Malraux's 1967 concept of art by destination and art by metamorphosis. Some of the ritual objects that are intended for a different location and a different purpose are being recontextualized and are thus effectively appropriated and metamorphosized. For example, kolam competitions have become an annual event in Chennai. Every year in Chennai, one can see the art of drawing these ritual designs, which was originally intended for ritual spaces and religious occasions, are being metamorphosized into competitions where women of different ethnic groups compete for prize money and media coverage and subtly champion the ethnic value of their design. This phenomenon was also reinforced by a work of Nagarajan in 2001. The creation of the kolam, which was previously just a private affair in domestic spaces and places of worship, are now being channeled into the public arena with notions of public display and competitions. One can also see that these ritual designs are created in ethnographic museums or in heritage centers. Coming to my second example, which is called the gift basket or the Nagratar basket that is used during gift-giving rituals in their life cycle ceremonies. The process of aestheticization can be seen as an essential component of commoditization. The Nagratar basket, which was originally made by weaving palm leaves, saw its transformation into silver baskets during the increasing affluence among the Nagratars. The Nagratar women placed customized orders with the silversmiths of the Chennai city to reproduce them in silver. Thus, the Nagratar baskets appeared with a facelift, with their woven patterns effectively reproduced in the shiny metal. Given the prestige associated with the pure silver, these silver baskets became a status symbol and a reflection of wealth. As these baskets were made by the mainstream silversmiths, who would subsequently reproduce these designs and display them alongside their other products, several non-Nagratar customers were attracted by this novel item. The aesthetic attributes of the basket that attracted the non-Nagratas, according to a silversmith, were the intricate workmanship on the basket, the luster of the pure silver, polished silver, and the durability of the product. This relates to the 1996 list of aesthetic principles which were listed by Van Damme, which included the skill, brightness, and the novelty of an object. Soon these baskets were replicated in all sizes. Soon these baskets were replicated in all sizes, and depending on the affordability and the purchase capacity of the consumers, this basket became a commoner and entered many homes. The work of Fabian in 2007 explores the idea of collecting ethnographic objects and traces the ethnographic significance of paintings by studying their presence in living rooms and their commodity status that had a market with the urban population. Miller in 1998 argued that things are not just objectifications at the point of production, exchange, and consumption, but also during appropriation. Objects move through people's activities and in different contexts undergo transformations and produce new types of objects and activities. The Nagratar basket that was intended for a different location and purpose is being recontextualized and thus effectively appropriated into a collectible and a curio object. As many of the Nagratar ritual objects are imbued with deep-rooted aspects and characteristics of the Nagratar history and pantheon, these objects don't find a place in the religious and ritual spaces of other communities. However, they have today received a display space in the curio area in the living rooms of some Hindu families. An avid collector of ethnic objects says, "In my living room, I have a Nubian bow and arrow, a Nagratar basket, a musical instrument used during festivals in Kerala. These objects become conversation pieces during parties where my family and friends share our knowledge about the cultures that these objects belong to and how these objects are used in those cultures. I sometimes use this basket as a flower vase." The Chettiar basket therefore becomes one of the many collectibles belonging to many different cultures that are displayed in the living rooms and recontextualized and has a different function. While among the Nagratars, these baskets were predominantly used during the gift-giving ritual, as you can see in the image on the right, during their life cycle ceremonies such as marriages and pre-puberty ceremony. Among the non-Nagratars, they were appropriated as flower baskets that were kept on the welcoming table of weddings. The silver basket saw more transformations when they were made into turmeric and vermilion holders, as seen on the image on the right, which was commonly used by married Hindu women. This item became a collectible, a gift article, and a souvenir among the Nagratars and the non-Nagratars. Interestingly, when these objects are gifted to people outside India, it sometimes finds itself a different use. A Nagratar woman in Canada said, "I gifted one such holder to my colleague at work. She has found a new use for it. She puts paper clips in one holder and board pins in the other." Today, many of the Nagratars themselves project the gift basket as a handicraft whose traditional weaving skill is endangered. Some national and regional organizations, such as the Madras Craft Foundation and the Indian National Trust for Art and Cultural Heritage, are actively involved in the revival of lost traditions. A member of this craft organization says, "I experiment with the production of these baskets. I produce them in colors different from the natural color of the palm leaves. I use natural dyes, which have resulted in a whole new range of earthy shades that are exquisite and also eco-friendly. This gift basket has therefore become a basket that can be used as a waste paper basket, a laundry basket, and sometimes a lampshade by an innovative interior decorator. The ritual basket has therefore seen a very interesting trajectory from a palm leaf to a silver basket, to its reproduction in gifts and souvenirs, and to its production in eco-friendly materials. As the gift basket was used in ritual contexts as well as for mundane purposes by the Nagratars themselves, its appropriation by the non-Nagratars was perceived more as a handicraft and not as an object with deep ethnic roots or a sacred value." and also with several craft organizations propagating this item as part of heritage conservation and in the revival of basket weaving skill. These baskets have easily been integrated into the wider Tamil context. Moving to my last and final example about the saris. Among the Nagratas, the saris form an essential component during wedding gifts which are given for the bride from her parents, which are called as the seer. During the gift giving, the saris become an index of the agencies of the gift giver and the receiver, and are thereby reinforcing lasting kinship and social bonds and connections with the lineage and ancestry. Tiley in 2006 reiterates this view and argues how gift-giving in ritual contexts is one of the most powerful ways in which the identity of people in relation to others is created. People are objectified as affins or members of the same clan through the gifts that they give at a particular occasion. I'm going to skip around a little bit due to lack of time. The exchange of saris as gifts between the mothers of the bride and the groom is also an essential aspect of gift exchanges during marriages. These saris therefore become status symbols, and the giver tries to gift the best quality sari. Also, the saris, along with the rest of the bridal trousseau, is kept on display for the view of the wedding guests. The guests take a tour of this display. Once again, the sari becomes a status symbol there. The circulation of Hindu images can also be seen in the production of saris in Tamil Nadu. Some of the sari retailers in Tamil Nadu have reproduced images of gods, religious architecture, and scenes from the Hindu mythologies and epics in the saris in order to propel their agenda of brand building, improved visibility, and increased sales. A sari retail house in Chennai visualized and produced a sari that would carry the reproduction of one of the famous paintings depicting a scene from the Hindu epic Mahabharata, as you can see in this picture. This earned him the National Award for Master Weaver and Master Craft Person in 1999. This gave the proprietors an opportunity of displaying their sari in Delhi to the Prime Minister of India, thereby boosting the status of this regional product at a national level. Two other retailers in Chennai created innovative saris where images of Indian history and heritage were woven in the sari. Images of the architecture of the famous temples, such as the Shore Temple near Chennai, which is the one I show on the right, and the Brahadishwar Temple in Tanjore, were reproduced in the saris. One of the sari entered the Guinness Book of World Records for the world's longest silk sari, which were measured a whopping 1,276 feet, and it was taken on an exhibition tour to different places in Tamil Nadu, including Pondicherry, Cuddalur, and other southern cities. This sari was thus transformed into a priceless work of art. This image of Krishna was incorporated by another sari retailer in Chennai. The sari depicts a famous picture of Darbar Krishna, in which Swarovski crystals were also embedded. The image is believed to bring good luck to the owner. Kajuri Jain, in 2007, in her study of images of gods in calendars in India, argues how images possess the power to bring good fortune or become inauspicious. She also draws a connection between efficacy and imagination. Jell, in 1996, also explores how objects possess the capacity to have a causative effect. Birgit Meyer, in 2010,
suggests that religious things and images have the power to mediate between humans and God. Another interesting trajectory in the circulation of saris and its encounter with the devotees is visible in the context of temple rituals. It is common practice among the Tamils to donate saris for temple goddesses during temple services. These saris adorn the idols during the special services which are witnessed by the donors. As several families give such donations, the temples have a surplus inflow of such saris. Therefore, it is common practice among many temples in Tamil Nadu to have an auction of these saris, where many patrons buy them at a nominal price. Such a practice was also seen during my visit to Mississauga, Canada, in the Durga Temple, when I accompanied a Tamil woman to the temple, as she was browsing such saris in order to purchase one. There was a notice which was put up informing the patrons about the sale of such saris, and this is what it read in Tamil. Silk saris that have adorned the sacred body of Amman have thereby acquired great powers are on sale. These high quality silk saris, which normally cost about $200, are now priced at $10 to $75. The money you spend in purchasing these saris should be regarded as sacred donations and offerings to God. It is considered good and auspicious if every house possesses at least one such sari. Therefore, hurry to the sale and bring home as many as you need. A similar practice is also observed among the Tamil Christians in Chennai. Mother Mary at the Velangani Church in Chennai receives innumerable saris from devotees as a way of thanksgiving for Mother Mary for favors received or for difficulties eliminated, as the keykeeper of the chamber says. These saris, gifted by the devotees, are draped on the icon and then included in the auction held every Saturday, where many devotees are eager to purchase these saris, which now have become special because Mother has worn it, tells one of the attendees of the auction. This practice brings to light two notions. One is that of the efficacious object. The sari that adorns the idol of the goddess during the temple ritual or Mother Mary is believed to possess sacred powers because of its interaction and contact with the statue of the deity, and therefore now has the power to bring good fortune to anyone who may possess it. Secondly, it is also an example of what Appadurai calls as an ex-commodity. He defines ex-commodities as things that have been retrieved either temporarily or permanently from the commodity state and placed in another state. In the case of the above sari, the silk sari, which was primarily a commodity denoting luxury and status, has been removed from its commodity state. It has lost its monetary value and accrued sacred value in the context. Therefore, to quickly wrap up what I have so far discussed with regard to the three examples, the kolam, while continues to be primarily created using traditional materials in many parts of India, the diaspora market has brought about changes in its production. Also, while the kolam continues to be created primarily in the ritual context and religious spaces, it has also found an entrance in other arenas such as competitions and public display. Similarly, the gift basket, which continues to be used in gift giving, has undergone transformations and effectively appropriated in non-ritual contexts. It has also become instrumental in achieving the goals of heritage conservation and revival of traditions pursued by the arts and crafts organizations. Likewise, a commodity like the sari acquires new value and status according to its movements across different contexts. It changes from a commodity to a signifier of lineage, to a status symbol, to an efficacious object. I have also discussed how the incorporation of images of temple architecture and Hindu mythology into a sari has transformed them into works of arts and have become instrumental in gaining national awards and evoking regional pride. Therefore, today the ritual and the religious images and objects, apart from their originally foreseen meanings and usage, have circulated into new spaces, thereby becoming, for example, a showpiece exhibited in the living room and valued for its antiquity, or a souvenir to be gifted as a ceremony's take-home gift, or an art produced in an unconventional material about to be transported abroad, or an heirloom carrying the memories of a lineage and safely guarded in a joint family property. Therefore, in conclusion, I would like to say that while there are continuities in the creation and usage of ritual objects, some of these ritual objects are taking a different trajectory and enter different orbits of circulation. They are instrumental in continuing traditions as well as in spearheading and propelling innovations and creative improvisations. Thank you for listening. Should I go a bit beyond the time?
No.
Okay. We have some time for questions or comments.